Our family service starts now, and Charlie Schubert is going to come up and tell you something. Charlie is part of the program here today, as well as Dave LaDuca, and so we are going to tell you something about Charlie before he tells us something. Welcome, Charlie Schubert, one of our very own here. Here's Charlie's bio. I got a job in a bakery when I was 15. I needed a job because I had a girlfriend. I had just started my second year of high school at Taft High, now part of Lincoln City at the coast. The bakery still exists. It was a family bakery, a strong Australian boss, his wife and two boys, just older than I. I became part of that family. I worked there 4 years, went to school each morning. My shift was 4:30 to 7:30 a.m. till the school bus came. My teacher was able to audit and accommodated me with my class, as they knew I was learning a trade. I, as the third boy, was expected to listen, pay attention, and do as I was told. I was treated fairly, but was disciplined. At 19, I was a good apprentice baker. I loved my work. I was very fortunate to have had this early training from a master baker for my life's work. As an addendum, my girlfriend Shirley became my wife for 52 years. Charlie?
Okay. Well, talking in front of people always gets me, takes me a while to get going, but when I'm talking about my own trade, I think I probably get a few words out. If this is the spiritual or religious part of our service, I have a few thoughts about how I feel about bread. And bread, in this time, everybody's looking for organic foods. And bread really was our original organic food because, you know, it's made with yeast. It's alive. Yeast is sensitive to, just like we are, to time and temperature and how you feel. And if you, when you work with bread made with yeast and put in your all bread, sourdoughs, all yeast forms of making bread and rice are alive. And it's the only thing that we bake that is alive. And yeast feels just like we do. It doesn't want to get up in the morning. if you're cold in the morning and you're kind of keeping your coat pulled tight around you, yeast feels the same way, even if it's in an air-conditioned building. And like I said, it doesn't like to get up. If you make a dough in the middle of the night, you have to play with it. You have to make it warm and protect it. You make the same dough in the afternoon, and voila, boy, I'm wide awake and I'm ready to go. And I've talked to lots of bakers in my life, and they all will say, yeah, that's right, I know that. And so this gives you a great amount of respect for bread when you make it and bake it, nurture it, because that's what you have to do. You just can't put it together and go away and come back 2 or 3 hours later and expect to have a loaf of bread. You have to settle with it and watch it its whole time. And it responds to that. And you gain a lot of respect for baking bread if that's what you do. And it becomes one of the things that is so different than making cakes or cookies or something where you just stir it up, it's going to turn out. Because bread and yeast, I don't care what kind of bread it is, has to have that nurturing and attention. As far as other than the respect I have for bread, is different things that we've seem like we see all the time. Like, for instance, you know, in the Lord's Prayer, give us daily bread. It's always served most restaurants before your meal, and get plated bread. And it kind of tells you what kind of restaurant you're at. You get really good bread, nice and fresh, and not been warmed up in the microwave or something. You really kind of know the restaurants, what's going on. Talk about breaking bread as a symbol of sharing with people. It's called the staff of life. And it really is. In the back in the 30s, they used enriched flour. I think it was Greenland. They had a captured amount of people there. And rickets, or bull legs, was common. And I think we've all seen people, or know of people, because of lack of proper nutrition. And they cured that problem by enriched bread, enriched flour by law. You can't have flour that's not made by a mill that's not enriched. And so it's a total nutrition, and it has all the bran that you need in it, even white bread, and and it's nutritious and it keeps you healthy. So back to the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus fed a lot of people with 5 loaves of bread. And I'm not going to get into whether he fed all those people with it or not, but what he was talking about, we're still talking about. Enough for all. And that's the story of bread in that respect. And that's why I have so much respect for bread in my life's work. Thank you.
Instead of a reading today, Dave LaDuca is going to give us a meditation. And then I'll introduce Dave as our second speaker.
We're a community. So we're going to start the meditation facing right. And you want to place your palm very gently on your neighbor's back. Think of like a doctor and a stethoscope. Think of a doctor listening to a patient's lungs. You have many bells. Let's take some deep breaths and listen. And let's think, what is a doctor listening for? Maybe a symptom, a sign, some quantifiable variable that will guide the prescription, the diagnosis. Doctors will listen to our story, but they will want to listen to our lungs as well. How often do we listen and try to hear the deeper message? Okay, so we're going to reverse polarity and we're going to face to the left. Let's think about Charlie and his bread. And feel the rising and expansion of someone's living body. And feel someone behind you gauging your respiration as well. The baker needs the dough. And don't we need each other? So we're going to disengage gently from one another. And I want you to give thought to the following question. And if you have an answer, say it out loud. Name something that has no voice that you endeavor to listen to. The wind. The dog.
Water. Rain.
friend far away. It's your inner voice. Well, we've already given him a round of applause, but there was somebody I really wanted to listen to, and it was Charlie, and I'm so happy that he joined me today. So
I will introduce Dave, the speaker from my chair
out here.
Dave handed me this little tiny piece of paper when he came in today, and this is what he says. David LaDuca washed up on the shores of Wolf as a brother of a member that joined the hikers and the campouters. Now he chairs the Sunday Service Committee, organizes musical interludes, pens the December pageant, and his wife helps with RE and his sons help with daycare. Besides this, I believe, and six pageants, this is his first Sunday service as speaker. Please welcome Dave LaDuca.
Thank you. My volunteer work in Asia, South America, Central America, New York, Atlanta, and Oregon have all benefited from really listening to the voiceless, to those that felt ignored or unheard. And I call the central theme of my talk today, mutual inspiration. It starts with a story about Polo Cabá. Polo Cabá is a small Amazon island populated by an African culture that was marooned there during slavery times a long time ago and is still often isolated and often deserted. The whole country that we worked in was decimated by a civil war in the early 1990s, and the interior was just left to starve. And people that live in the interior in this Amazon kind of environment, they still remember starvation, the fear of bombings, and Polo Cabá, the village of Polo Cabá, wanted to improve itself, and it invited us to help them. We were Peace Corps volunteers. Village captain, I said, we thank you for coming. Village elder, I said, so happy you live and breathe. Women and children, your island is a joyful and peaceful place. And I bring to you a question. If you bring home meat from the jungle and your boat has walked a long, long way and the hut where you live so quiet, so dark, and your lantern and candle and cook fire and stove are cold and silent, what will you light first? And the village captain, he spoke eloquently for about 15 minutes about the cook fire and how it was central and the most important, and it brought warmth and food and life. I listen to your words, Captain, and I nod, for you speak with wisdom and truth, but you are not right. Something else must be lit first. Village elder, he spoke about the lantern and how it provided a light that would hang high and spreading light the widest. The lantern was easy to find, easy to light, best way to get started. I listen to your words, elder, and I applaud the clarity and purpose, but you are not right. Something else must be lit first. Maybe another member of the community has a thought to share. Well, the men were eager to answer and to speak up and to raise their hand and to control the conversation, but there was a woman named Ma Sanjali, and she, like, shook awoke. she raised her hand, and she had a gleam in her eyes. A match, she said. A match to start them all. Well, we held a vote to decide on a project to help the village and light the match. I told them no idea should be considered too small to get started, to get us started. Well, the elder, you know, he wanted a new motorboat so he could help his village. And the captain, of course, he wanted a new office where he could help his village. And 14 women, they wanted a portable mill for the cassava root that they grew in the jungle to help them make bread. Well, the elder, he was upset. His one vote seemed kind of small and insufficient. And the captain, he was outraged. If I didn't vote for the cassava mill, do I have to waste my time on this project? Well, I said, it will fall upon the shoulders of those that voted for it. So there began the Polo Cabal Women's Organization, and their success was their success. Peace Corps doesn't always leave behind self-sustaining projects, but, I mean, that's their goal, but they don't always do that. But both Beth and I were very happy with the results, and the women of Polo Cabal inspired us. And we meant to inspire them. But in listening, it led to mutual inspiration, which is my topic, I guess. Different continent. In my work with English, I taught English in Guatemala and Oregon, and I still do. And I endeavored to teach English, but I utilized listening to guide and direct the lessons. Guatemala, they wanted pronunciation. How do you explain this? They had English teachers, they had English classrooms, they had English textbooks, they had English students, everybody was getting grades in English. Nobody spoke English. Not even the teachers. And if a student was really good in English class, they became the teacher. Still not speaking any English. So they begged me. We really want English, but we don't want what we're doing. We want English with pronunciation. Oregon, Hispanics, they want pronunciation too. But they want power. They want connection to family. In Woodburn, where I live in Oregon, many families, they feel powerless over their family situation. Their children, at a very early age, they go to school. And even though Woodburn schools are dual language, bilingual, and everybody's learning Spanish and English, their children learn English really quickly at a very young age. And they find English to be a way to be free from their parents. Yeah, it's a struggle. And it puts many adults into my class. And I listen to these themes, I listen to their questions and their goals, and I try to put their goals and themes and questions at the very top of the lesson. Different continent. I studied in India, part of college, and I went to visit Calcutta during the late 1980s when Mother Teresa was convalescing. She had a quadruple bypass surgery, And I went, it was like going to Disneyland and saying, where's Mickey Mouse? You know, I was like, I'm in Calcutta, I want to see Mother Teresa. You know, it was like one of those stupid things, you know. And they're like, you know, she's convalescing. I mean, you're not going to see her. And I looked for her, and I saw her in Kids, and I saw her in the projects that she started, and I could feel her. And why wasn't that enough? Why did I have to take a selfie with her? Well, as I was looking for her, I found that Mother Teresa had some kind of a strange deal. She allowed people to publish her works that from speeches that she gave. You were allowed to transcribe her speeches, put them in a book, and sell them. And she was fine with that. So it wasn't like books about her. It was speeches made by her, available all over the place. So it was really nice. It was a really cool thing that she did, letting people publish these books. And I was reading in the book, and there was a story that really jumped out at me. And it was about a priest who arrived at her mission declaring that he had a special mission from God to serve the blind. No, you don't, said Mother Teresa. And the priest was so surprised. And Mother Teresa continued and said, you have a special mission from God to serve whoever walks in that door and asks for help. How surprised he must have been. I went to a rosary reading at the orphanage and the chapel near the orphanage, and we were praying the rosary, and I realized how foolish I had been hoping to see Mother Teresa, and I realized that I was surrounded by Mother Teresa until she walked in and sat next to me. And then I said a rosary bead for everybody I knew, because I knew they'd really count it. How surprised I was. How surprised the first baker was when yeast was included in her bread for the first time, right? She must have been very surprised. What a difference listening can make. That there's someone living and breathing, sitting right next to you with their own story, their own journey, and their own perspective. Learning a new language, visiting a house of worship in a faraway place, making a friend with a different point of view, spending time in an RE class with your youth here at WOOF, making bread to share, preparing a Sunday service. All these things, they're not one directional. It's not like I'm making something that completely comes from me and I'm giving it to you guys. Charlie inspires me. And I'm just trying to repay the favor. That's mutual inspiration. Thank you. I'm going to come down here and stand with Charlie. If you have questions, we can do that.
Oh, good. I was going to mention questions. Before that happens, please, everybody, come downstairs afterwards. There is an abundance of breads, all different kinds of breads, and they are labeled, and we are required to taste it. So it is question time now for Charlie and Dave. Would you...
The microphone, Jim?
I have it right here. You can give it back to me if you want to.
For people to ask. That's
right.
I'll get it back
in
my phone.
This one's for me and Charlie. No, stay here, Charlie. It's okay. We can move there.
We're good. And then pass around.
So if you have questions for me or Charlie, we want the bread.
Well, I have a little story about a wonderful Latino boy named Juan, who was one of my many students of different colors at a school where I taught for so long. And he came running to me at 2:30 in the afternoon and said, Mrs. C, I have to leave. And I said, oh, how come? And he said, well, I have to go out to Hillsboro to do some auto dealing for my father because we're going to get a new car, but I'm the only one in my family who can do the deal. So I always thought about that and how empowered Juan must have felt and how grateful his family must have felt for him. He was 12.
Thank you to you both. It was inspirational. The theme of mutual inspiration. And as someone who deals a lot with education and teaching, I want to hear more about what you've discovered, Dave, with you know, what works when it comes to teaching language. You were talking about listening from the teacher's perspective, but you also, because you made me think that when we're learning language, 90% of what we're doing is listening to begin with. Do you encourage that? And do you think that really helps people acquire language?
I think some of the things that I've done along the way is try to make students the author of some of the things that I do. I have Via Baltazar, which is the road of Baltazar, and he's one of my students. And he was just like, I'm having trouble with this. And I said, well, let's pave the road, you know, for you, for other people, and now it's named after you. And I think that's just something that you kind of give the credit to other people. I have a class each season. And some students repeat, but the goal is to move up to the next level. But every time I have a new season, I make a brand new workbook, it's only 10 pages or 8 pages. And so that if somebody does come back, they feel like they're getting something new. And I say, you know, what we do in class is going to, you know, encourage me to make it better or more interesting or more exciting. And then another thing I do is, because it's a 2.5-hour class, I try to stop, you know, every now and then and look for the person who's the most lost. And I give them some choices. I was like, do you want to do more pronunciation? Do you want to do more grammar? Do you want to do something new? And they look at me and they're like, oh my gosh. I'm like, it is your class. You are paying. And it tries to include, you know, it tries to allow them to hear. Somebody came to class and they had a letter that they got from the university that we work, you know, that I work at. And it was all in English. I was like, what is going on, you know? And they're like, we don't understand any of this. And so I said, okay, I'm going to photocopy this. I'm going to make copies for everybody in class. And we're going to work on this because this is important. And I always make fun of Mr. Rabbit and Mr. Fox. I was like, I'm not sitting here working out of a workbook talking about Mr. Fox. I want to talk about ear problems. I want to talk about imaginary people that are in a book. You know, I want to talk about your needs and your problems. And I think that they get it, and they kind of feed off each other, and they're like, well, he asked about his life. I want to ask about my life. And we did a whole section on trees because somebody said they cut down trees. So they were pulled up and cutting down trees just to make a point about, you know, English. So it's it's not something, if you really like lesson plans, it's not for you, because you have to really, you have to go in it kind of expecting some chaos.
I'd like to thank you both for a wonderful presentation. And I do have a question for Charlie. I understand that the bakery, Charlie, it's Cheyenne over here.
He has a microphone.
I have.
Okay, excellent. I understand that your bakery actually has an award-winning program for helping people who perhaps have been in prison reintegrating and becoming employed. And I wondered if you could talk about some of the types of employment opportunities and other things that you've been able to accomplish at the bakery.
Well, through the court system, Judge Don is retired, and he recognized that there was many people who had needed a second chance. Not everybody, but there's always this one person that has had a better and a second chance. My daughter has been a part of that second chance program for 8 years, and she just retired, and so did the judge. But the way that works is the judge gives them, instead of a sentence, a job. They can get a job, and we sponsored over 200 people. And they come to work, and they live in whatever group home they live in. And as long as they don't make one mistake about going back on drugs or whatever reason they're there, rather than going to jail, they keep going. But they only have one chance. That's it. And I never know who these people are. Some of them have been with us for years and years and went on to be regular permanent employees. Some one day you look and Juan's gone or Jane's gone. They just didn't make it. But it's been a interesting program, and it seems there's a national program funded by the government, and they've been looking for a sponsor, and they like bakeries because there's lots of handwork in bakeries, so bakeries going to sponsor a statewide program for Seven Chance, and that came through Merkley. Senator Merkley, and she met with, when my daughter went back to the prison and saw citations, she met with Merkley and Wyden and some of those people. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but.
We still have a little time if you have some time for a question.
I didn't bring my joke book this time, sorry.
Doesn't anybody want to know how to make bread? Seems like that's the number one question I always get, is I'd sure like to learn how to make bread. It is not hard, it's so easy. All you need is flour, water, and yeast, and salt, and a bowl. That's all you need. And you make what they call no-knead bread. Put this all together. You don't have to have a mixer or anything. And the thing will rise by itself and develop its own protein, which is what makes the bread elastic. And if you doubt that, sometime, I think you've made pie dough or something, you made your fingers wet, and you get some flour on your hands, and you've got this almost like high school glue on your fingers. You can't get rid of it. That's the protein that's already developing. So, if you want to try to make bread, just look on the internet for no-knead bread. You'll find all kinds of recipes. And I can tell you that you have to pay attention to it, and you have to work with it for a few hours during the day. But if you do that for 3 times, the third time, the first loaf of bread might be so great, the second one will be better, the third one will be a great loaf of bread. But you have to do it. You have to get the practice in the wheel, in the feel of it, And it's like learning to speak a language. If you never learn to pronounce the words, you're not going to learn to speak the words. And if you don't practice making the bread at least twice, within a reasonable length of time, I don't mean, you know, once a week to 3 weeks, and you're a bread baker. Yes.
Baker, and then when did you start your own shop, or the job that you... 1967,
my girlfriend moved to Portland, so I had to quit my job to get, be next to her. I came to Portland, and I worked at Friends for a little while, and then they had a union strike, and then after that I went back to working in what we call the hand shops rather than the wholesale shops. I got a job at Deers and Bakery temporarily, and during the strike my wife and I got married. That was in May 2nd, July 2nd. I was working at the bakery after I didn't go back to Friends, and I've been there since. In 67 I bought the bakery. I worked there 14 years.
Charlie, there's a question back here for you if you have a chance to answer it.
I just had a brief comment. My mother taught school for about 30 years, and she taught in Chicago suburbs. And in 1946, right after World War II, a child who spoke from China who spoke no English was put in her class, and it took, I don't know, several weeks at least for him to feel like speaking up. And when he did speak up, it was kind of a gift to her. They were out in the hallway, and a number of students at the drinking fountain, and he turned on the drinking fountain, and he said, "Drink, kicha." And so she leaned over and drank, and then she said, "Drink, tui mi." And that was the first conversation they had.
I think this is possibly our last question.
Charlie, I know you're a purist when it comes to bread, but I sometime in my past, because I never tend to think ahead, I read something about how to rise your bread and using the microwave, and I can do that. So I hope I'm not, I don't know, I do that.
Well, probably the microwave keeps it warm, but if you turn it up too much, you're gonna fry the yeast, and it doesn't like that. Yeah.
Charlie and Dave, thank you so much for your dual presentation.